Yes, it was in the up and locked position. Again, Casey noted the terminology. A pilot would say up and locked. Would a flight attendant? Did he say anything else? He was concerned about the autopilot. He said the autopilot kept trying to cut in, to take over the plane. He said, I had to fight the autopilot for control. I see. And what was Captain Chang's manner at this time? He was calm as always. He is a very good captain. The girl's eyes flickered nervously. She twisted her hands in her lap. Casey decided to wait for a moment. It was an old interrogator's trick. Let the subject break the silence. Captain Chang comes from a family of pilots, Kei Liang said, swallowing. His father was a pilot during the war, and his son is a pilot as well, his son.
I see.
The flight attendant lapsed into silence again. There was a pause. She looked down at her hands, then back up. So, is there anything else I can tell you?
Outside the cubicle, Richmond said, Isn't this the thing you said couldn't happen, uncommanded SLAT's deployment?
I didn't say it couldn't happen. I said I didn't believe it was possible on this aircraft.
And if it did, it raises more questions than it answers. And what about the autopilot?
Too early to tell, she said, and went into the next cubicle. It must have been around 6 o'clock, Emily said, shaking her head. She was a slender woman of 30 with a purple bruise on her cheek. An infant slept on her lap. Her husband lay in the bed behind her. A metal brace ran from his shoulders to his chin. She said his jaw was broken.
I had just fed the baby. I was talking to my husband, and then I heard a sound.
What sort of sound?
A rumbling or a grinding sound. I thought it came from the wing.
Not good, Casey thought.
So I looked out the window at the wing.
Did you see anything unusual?
No, it all looked normal. I thought the sound might be coming from the engine, but the engine looked normal, too.
Where was the sun that morning?
On my side, shining in on my side.
So was there sunlight on the wing?
Yes.
Reflecting back at you?
Emily Jansen shook her head.
I don't really remember.
Was the seatbelt sign on?
No, never.
Did the captain make an announcement?
No.
Going back to this sound, you described it as a rumble?
Something like that. I don't know if I heard it or felt it. It was almost a vibration.
Like a vibration. How long did this vibration last?
Several seconds.
5 seconds?
Longer. I would say 10 or 12 seconds.
A classic description of a SLAT's deployment in flight, Casey thought.
Okay, she said. And then?
The plane started going down, Jansen gestured with the flat of her hand.
Like that.
Casey continued to make notes, but she no longer really listened. She was trying to put together the sequence of events, trying to decide how the engineers should proceed. There was no question that both witnesses were telling a story consistent with SLAT's deployment. First rumbling for 12 seconds, exactly the time it took the SLATs to extend. Then a slight nose-up, which would occur next, and then porpoising as the crew tried to stabilize the aircraft.
What a mess, she thought.
Emily Jansen was saying,
Since the cockpit door was open, I could hear all the alarms. There were warning sounds and voices in English that sounded recorded.
Do you remember what they said?
It sounded like, fall, fall, something like that.
It was the stall alarm, Casey thought. And the audio reminder was saying, stall, stall. Damn. She stayed with Emily Jansen a few minutes more, and then went back outside.
In the corridor, Richmond said, Does that rumbling sound mean the SLAT's deployed?
It might, she said. She was tense, edgy. She wanted to get back to the aircraft and talk to the engineers.
From one of the curtained cubicles farther down the corridor, she saw a stocky, gray-haired figure emerge. She was surprised to see it was Mike Lee. She felt a burst of irritation. What the hell was the carrier rep doing talking to passengers? It was very inappropriate. Lee had no business being here. She remembered what Kei Liang had said.
A Chinese man was just here. Lee came up toward them, shaking his head.
Mike, she said, I'm surprised to see you here.
Why, you should give me a medal, he said. A couple of the passengers were considering lawsuits. I talked them out of it.
But, Mike, she said, you talked to crew members before we did. That's not right.
What do you think, I fed them a story? Hell, they gave me the story. And there's not much doubt about what happened. Lee stared at her. I'm sorry, Casey, but Flight 545 had an uncommanded SLATS deploy, and that means you've still got problems on the N-22.
Walking back to the van, Richmond said,
What did he mean you've still got problems?
Casey sighed. No point in holding back now, she said. We've had some incidents of SLATS deployment on the N-22.
Wait a minute, Richmond said. You mean this has happened before?
Not like this, she said. We've never had serious injuries. But yes, we've had problems with SLATs. En route, 1:05 p.m. The first episode occurred 4 years ago on a flight to San Juan, Casey said as they drove back. SLATs extended in mid-flight. At first, we thought it was an anomaly, but then there were two additional incidents within a couple of months. When we investigated, we found that in every case, the SLATs had deployed during a period of flight deck activity, right after a crew change or when they punched in coordinates for the next leg of the flight or something like that. We finally realized the SLATs lever was getting knocked loose by the crews, banged by clipboards, caught on uniform sleeves.
You're kidding, Richmond said.
No, she said. We'd built a locking slot for the lever like park on an automobile transmission. But despite the slot, the lever was still being accidentally dislodged. Richmond was staring at her with the skeptical expression of a prosecuting attorney.
So the N-22 does have problems.
It was a new aircraft, she said, and all aircraft have problems when they're first introduced. You can't build a machine with a million parts and not have snags. We do everything we can to avoid them. First we design, then we test the design, then we build, then we flight test. But there are always going to be problems. The question is how to resolve them.
How do you resolve them?
Whenever we discover a problem, we send the operators a heads-up, called a service bulletin, which describes our recommended fix. But we don't have the authority to mandate compliance. Some carriers implement, some don't. If the problem persists, the FAA gets into the act and issues an airworthiness directive to the carriers, requiring them to fix the planes in service within a specified time. But there are always ADs for every model aircraft. We're proud of the fact that Norton has fewer than anyone else.
So you say.
Go look it up. They're all on file at Oak City.
At what?
Every AD that's ever been issued is on file at the FAA's Technical Center in Oklahoma City.
So you had one of these ADs on the N-22? Is that what you're telling me?
We issued a service bulletin recommending the carriers install a hinged metal cover that sits over the lever. That meant the captain had to flip up the cover before he could deploy the slats. But it solved the problem. As usual, some carriers made the fix, others didn't. So the FAA issued an AD making it mandatory. That was 4 years ago. There's been only one incident since then, but that involved an Indonesian carrier who didn't install the cover. In this country, the FAA requires carriers to comply, but abroad, she shrugged, the carriers do what they want.
That's it? That's the whole history?
That's the whole history. The IRT investigated, the metal covers were installed on the fleet, and there haven't been any more SLATS problems on the N-22.
Until now, Richmond said.
That's right. Until now. LAX Maintenance Hangar, 1:22 p.m.
A what?
Kenny Burns said, shouting from the cockpit of Trans-Pacific 545.
They said it was a what?
Uncommanded SLATS deployment, Richmond said.
Ah, blow me, Burns said.
He started climbing out of the seat.
What a crock of shit. Hey, Clarence, come in here. See that seat? That's the first officer's seat. Sit down there.
Richmond was hesitant. Come on, Clarence, get in the damn seat.
Awkwardly, Richmond squeezed between the other men in the cockpit and got into the first officer's chair on the right.
Okay, Burns said. You comfy in there, Clarence? You're not a pilot by any chance.
No,
Richmond said.
Okay, good. So, here you are, all set to fly the plane. Now, you see straight ahead?
He pointed to the control panel directly in front of Richmond, which consisted of three video screens, each 4 inches square.
You got your three-color CRTs showing your primary flight display, navigation display, and on the left, systems display. All those little semicircles represent a different system. All green, meaning everything's fine. Now, on the roof above your head, that's your overhead instrument panel. All the lights are out, which means everything is fine. It's dark unless there's a problem. Now, to your left is what we call the pedestal.
Byrne pointed to a boxy structure that protruded between the two seats. There were a half dozen levers and slots on the pedestal.
Now, from right to left, flaps ahead, he pointed. You got slats, two throttles for the engines, spoilers, brakes, thrusters. Slats and flaps are controlled by that lever nearest you, the one with the little metal cover over it. See it?
I see it, Richmond said.
Good. Flip up the cover and engage the slats.
Engage the...
Pull the slats lever down, Byrne said.
Richmond flicked up the cover and struggled for a moment to move the lever.
No. Grab it firmly. Pull it up, then right, then down, Byrne said, just like a gear shift on a car.
Richmond closed his fingers around the handle. He pulled the lever up, across, and down. There was a distant hum.
Good, Byrne said. Now look at your display. See that amber slats EXTD indicator? It's telling you the slats are coming out of the leading edge, okay? Takes 12 seconds to fully extend. Now they're out, and the indicator is white, and says, slats.
I see, Richmond said.
Okay, now retract the slats.
Richmond reversed his actions, pushing the lever up, sliding it left and down to locked position, then closing the cover over the handle.
That, Byrne said, is a commanded slats extension.
Okay, Richmond said.
Now let's perform an uncommanded slats extension.
How do I do that?
Any way you can, pal. For starters, hit it with the side of your hand.
Richmond reached across the pedestal, brushing the lever with his left hand, but the cover protected it. Nothing happened.
Come on, hit that sucker.
Richmond swung his hand laterally back and forth, banging against the metal. He hit it harder and harder each time, but nothing happened. The cover protected the handle. The slats lever remained up and locked.
Maybe you could knock it with your elbow, Byrne said. Or tell you what, try this clipboard here,
he said, pulling a clipboard from between the seats and giving it to Richmond.
Go on, give it a good whack. I'm looking for an accident here.
Richmond struck the lever with the clipboard. It clanged against the metal. He turned the clipboard and pushed the lever with one edge. Nothing happened.
You want to keep on trying?
Byrne said.
Or you're starting to get the point. It can't be done, Clarence. Not with that cover in place.
Maybe the cover wasn't in place, Richmond said.
Hey, Byrne said, that's good thinking. Maybe you can knock the cover up by accident. Try that with your clipboard, Clarence.
Richmond swung the clipboard at the edge of the cover, but the surface was smoothly curved and the clipboard just slid off. The cover remained closed.
No way to do it, Byrne said. Not by accident. So, what's the next thought?
Maybe the cover was already up.
Good idea, Byrne said. They're not supposed to be flying with the cover up, but who the hell knows what they did. Go ahead and lift the cover up.
Richmond lifted the cover up on its hinge. The handle was now exposed.
Okay, Clarence, go to it.
Richmond swung his clipboard at the handle, banging it hard, but with most lateral movements, the raised cover still acted as a protection. The clipboard hit the cover before it struck the handle. Several times, on impact, the cover dropped back down again. Richmond had to keep stopping to lift the cover up again before he could proceed.
Maybe if you used your hand, Byrne suggested.
Richmond tried swiping at the handle with his palm. In a few moments, the side of his hand was red, and the lever remained firmly up and locked.
Okay, he said, sitting back in the seat. I get the point.
It can't be done, Byrne said. It simply can't be done. An uncommanded SLATS deploy is impossible on this aircraft. Period.
From outside the cockpit, Daugherty said,
Are you guys finished screwing around? Because I want to pull the recorders and go home.
As they came out of the cockpit, Byrne touched Casey on the shoulder and said,
See you a minute?
Sure, she said. He led her back in the plane, out of earshot of the others. He leaned close to her and said,
What do you know about that kid?
Casey shrugged. He's a Norton relative.
What else?
Marta assigned him to me.
You check him out?
No, Casey said. If Marta sent him, I assume he's fine.
Well, I talked to my friends in marketing, Byrne said. They say he's a weasel. They say don't turn your back on him.
Kenny,
I'm telling you something's wrong with that kid, Casey. Check him out.
With a metallic whir from the power screwdrivers, the floor panels came away, revealing a maze of cables and boxes under the cockpit.
Jesus, Richmond said, staring. Ron Smith was directing the operation, running his hand over his bald head nervously.
That's fine, he said. Now get the panel to the left.
How many boxes we got on this bird, Ron? Daugherty asked.
152, Smith said. Anybody else, Casey knew, would have to thumb through a thick sheaf of schematics before he answered. But Smith knew the electrical system by heart.
What are we pulling? Daugherty said.
Pull the CVR, the DFDR, and the QAR, if they got one, Smith said.
You don't know if there's a QAR? Daugherty asked, teasing him.
Optional, Smith said. It's a customer install. I don't think they put one in. Usually on the N-22 it's in the tail, but I looked and didn't find one.
Richmond turned to Casey. He was looking puzzled again. I thought they were getting the black boxes.
We are, Smith said.
There's 152 black boxes?
Oh, hell, Smith said. They're all over the aircraft, but we're only after the main ones now, the 10 or 12 NVMs that count.
NVMs, Richmond repeated. You got it, Smith said, and he turned away, bending over the panels.
It was left to Casey to explain. The public perception of an aircraft was that it was a big mechanical device with pulleys and levers that moved control surfaces up and down. In the midst of this machinery were two magic black boxes, recording events in the flight. These were the black boxes that were always talked about on news programs. The CVR, the cockpit voice recorder, was essentially a very sturdy tape deck. It recorded the last half hour of cockpit conversation into a continuous loop of magnetic tape. Then there was the DFDR, the digital flight data recorder, which stored details of the behavior of the airplane so that investigators could discover what had happened after an accident. But this image of an aircraft, Casey explained, was inaccurate for a large commercial transport. Commercial jets had very few pulleys and levers. Indeed, few mechanical systems of any sort. Nearly everything was hydraulic and electrical. The pilot in the cockpit didn't move the ailerons or flaps by force of muscle. Instead, the arrangement was like power steering on an automobile. When the pilot moved the control stick and pedal, he sent electrical impulses to actuate hydraulic systems, which in turn moved the control surfaces. The truth was that a commercial airliner was controlled by a network of extraordinarily sophisticated electronics, dozens of computer systems linked together by hundreds of miles of wiring. There were computers for flight management, for navigation, for communication. Computers regulated the engines, the control surfaces, the cabin environment. Each major computer system controlled a whole array of subsystems. Thus, the navigation system ran the ILS for instrument landing, the DME for distance measuring,
the ATC for air traffic control, the TCAS for collision avoidance, the GPWS for ground proximity warning. In this complex, electronic environment, it was relatively easy to install a digital flight data recorder. Since all the commands were already electronic, they were simply routed through the DFDR and stored on magnetic media. A modern DFDR records 80 separate flight parameters every second of the flight.
Every second? How big is this thing? Richmond said.
It's right there, Casey said, pointing. Ron was pulling an orange and black striped box from the radio rack. It was the size of a large shoebox. He set it on the floor and replaced it with a new box for the ferry flight back to Burbank. Richmond bent over and lifted the DFDR by one stainless steel handle.
Heavy.
That's the crash-resistant housing, Ron said. The actual doohickey weighs maybe 6 ounces.
And the other boxes, what about them?
The other boxes existed, Casey said, to facilitate maintenance. Because the electronic systems of the aircraft were so complicated, it was necessary to monitor the behavior of each system in case of errors or faults during flight. Each system tracked its own performance in what was called non-volatile memory.
That's NVM.
They would download 8 NVM systems today. The flight management computer, which stored data on the flight plan and the pilot-entered waypoints, the digital engine controller, which managed fuel burn and power plant, the digital air data computer, which recorded airspeed, altitude, and overspeed warnings.
Okay, Richmond said. I think I get the point.
None of this would be necessary, Ron Smith said, if we had the QAR.
QAR?
It's another maintenance item, Casey said. Maintenance crews need to come on board after the plane lands and get a fast readout of anything that went wrong on the last leg.
Don't they ask the pilots?
Pilots will report problems, but with a complex aircraft there may be faults that never come to their attention, particularly since these aircraft are built with redundant systems. For any important system like hydraulics, there's always a backup, and usually a third as well. A fault in the second or third backup may not show in the cockpit. So the maintenance crews come on board and go to the quick access recorder, which spits out data from the previous flight. They get a fast profile and do the repairs on the spot.
But there's no quick access recorder on this plane.
Apparently not, she said. It's not required. FAA regulations require a CVR and a DFDR. The quick access recorder is optional. Looks like the carrier didn't put one on this plane.
At least I can't find it, Ron said. But it could be anywhere.
He was down on his hands and knees, bent over a laptop computer plugged into the electrical panels. Data scrolled down the screen.
This looks like data from the flight control computer, Casey said. Most of the faults occurred on one leg when the incident occurred.
But how do you interpret this? Richmond said.
Not our problem, Ron Smith said. We just offload it and bring it back to Norton. The kids in digital feed it into mainframes and convert it to a video of the flight.
We hope, Casey said. She straightened. How much longer, Ron?
10 minutes, max, Smith said.
Oh, sure, Daugherty said from inside the cockpit.
10 minutes, max, oh, sure. Not that it matters. I wanted to beat rush hour traffic, but now I guess I can't. It's my kid's birthday, and I won't be home for the party. My wife's going to give me hell.
Ron Smith was starting to laugh.
Can you think of anything else that might go wrong, Doug?
Oh. Sure, lots of things. Salmonella in the cake, all the kids poisoned, Daugherty said.
Casey looked out the door. The maintenance people had all climbed off the wing. Byrne was finishing up his inspection of the engines. Trung was loading the DFDR into the van. It was time to go home.
As she started down the stairs, she noticed 3 Norton security vans parked in a corner of the hangar. There were about 20 security guards standing around the plane and in various parts of the hangar.
Richmond noticed, too.
What's this about? He said, gesturing to the guards.
We always put security on the plane until it's ferried to the plant,
he said. That's a lot of security.
Yeah, well, Casey shrugged. It's an important plane.
But she noticed that the guards all wore sidearms. Casey couldn't remember seeing armed guards before. A hangar at LAX was a secure facility. There wasn't any need for the guards to be armed. Was there?
Building 64, 4:30 p.m. Casey was walking through the northeast corner of Building 64, past the huge tools on which the wing was built. The tools were crisscrossed blue steel scaffolding, rising 20 feet above the ground. Although they were the size of a small apartment building, the tools were precisely aligned to within a thousandth of an inch. Up on the platform formed by the tools, 80 people were walking around, putting the wing together. To the right, she saw groups of men packing tools into large wooden crates.
What's all that? Richmond said.
Looks like rotables, Casey said.
Rotables?
Spare tooling that we rotate into the line if something goes wrong with the first set. We built them to gear up for the China sale. The wing's the most time-consuming part to build. So the plan is to build the wings in our facility in Atlanta and ship them back here.
She noticed a figure in a shirt and tie, shirt sleeves rolled up, standing among the men working on the crates. It was Don Brull, the president of the UAW local. He saw Casey, called to her, and started toward her. He made a flickering gesture with his hand. She knew what he wanted.
Casey said to Richmond, "Give me a minute. I'll see you back at the office."
"Who is that?" Richmond said.
"I'll meet you back at the office."
Richmond remained standing there as Brule came closer. "Maybe you want me to stay and..."
"Bob," she said, "get lost."
Reluctantly, Richmond headed back toward the office. He kept glancing over his shoulder as he walked away.
Brule shook her hand. The UAW president was a short and solidly built man, an ex-boxer with a broken nose. He spoke in a soft voice.
"You know, Casey, I always liked you."
"Thanks, Don," she said. "Feelings mutual."
"Those years when you were on the floor, I always kept my eye on you, kept you out of trouble."
"I know that, Don."
She waited. Brule was notorious for long windups. "I always thought Casey isn't like the others." "What's going on, Don?" she said. "We got some problems with this China sale," Brule said.
"What kind of problems?"
"Problems with the offset."
"What about it?" she said, shrugging. "You know there's always offset with a big sale."
In recent years, airframe manufacturers had been obliged to send portions of the fabrication overseas, to the countries ordering planes. A country that ordered 50 planes expected to get a piece of the action. It was standard procedure.
"I know,"
Brule said. "But in the past, you guys sent part of the tail, maybe the nose, maybe some interior fab. Just parts."
"That's right."
"But these tools we're crating up," he said, "are for the wing. And Teamsters on the loading dock are telling us these crates aren't going to Atlanta. They're going to Shanghai. The company's going to give the wing to China."
"I don't know the details of the agreement," she said, "but I doubt that..."
"The wing, Casey," he said. "That's core technology. Nobody ever gives away the wing. Not Boeing, nobody. You give the Chinese the wing, you give away the store. They don't need us anymore. They can build the next generation of planes on their own. 10 years from now, nobody here has a job."
"Don," she said, "I'll check into this, but I can't believe the wing is part of the offset agreement."
Brule spread his hands. "I'm telling you it is."
"Don, I'll check for you, but right now I'm pretty busy with this 545 incident and..."
"You're not listening, Casey. The locals got a problem with the China sale."
"I understand that, but..."
"A big problem." He paused, looked at her. "Understand?" She did. The UAW workers on the floor had absolute control over production. They could slow down, sick out, break tooling, and create hundreds of other intractable problems. I'll talk to Martyr, she said. I'm sure he doesn't want a problem on the line.
Martyr is the problem.
Casey sighed. Typical Union misinformation, she thought. The China sale had been made by Hal Edgerton and the marketing team. Martyr was just the COO. He ran the plant. He didn't have anything to do with sales. I'll get back to you tomorrow, Don.
That's fine, Brühl said. But I'm telling you, Casey, personally, I'd hate to see anything happen.
Don, she said, are you threatening me?
No, no, Brühl said quickly with a pained expression. Don't misunderstand. But I hear that if the 545 thing isn't cleared up fast, it could kill the China sale.
That's true.
And you're speaking for the IRT.
That's true, too.
Brühl shrugged. So, I'm telling you, feelings are strong against the sale. Some of the guys are pretty hot about it. I was you, I'd take a week off.
I can't do that. I'm right in the middle of the investigation.
Brühl looked at her.
Don, I'll talk to Martyr about the wing, she said, but I have to do my job.
In that case, Brühl said, putting his hand on her arm, you take real good care, honey.
Administration, 4:40 p.m.
No, no, Martyr said, pacing in his office. This is nonsense, Casey. There's no way we'd send the wing to Shanghai. What do they think? We're crazy? That'd be the end of the company.
But Brühl said,
the Teamsters are screwing with the UAW, that's all. You know how rumors run through the plant. Remember when they all decided composites made you sterile? Damn guys wouldn't come to work for a month, but it wasn't true. And this one's not true either. The tools are going to Atlanta, he said. And for one very good reason. We're fabbing the wing in Atlanta so that the senator from Georgia will stop messing with us every time we go into the Ex-Im Bank for a big loan. It's a jobs program for the senior senator from Georgia. Got it?
Then somebody better get the word out, Casey said.
Christ, Martyr said. They know this. The union rep sits in on all the management meetings. It's usually Brühl himself.
But he didn't sit in on the China negotiations.
I'll speak to him, Martyr said.
Casey said, I'd like to see the offset agreement.
And you will, as soon as it's final.
What are we giving them?
Part of the nose and the empennage, Martyr said. Same as we did for France. Hell, we can't give them anything else. They're not competent to build it.
Brühl was talking about interfering with the IRT to stop the China sale.
Interfering? How? Martyr said, frowning at her. Did he threaten you?
Casey shrugged.
What did he say?
He recommended a week's vacation.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Martyr said, throwing up his hands. This is ridiculous. I'll talk to him tonight, straighten him out. Don't worry about this. Just stay focused on the job, okay?
Okay.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll take care of this for you.
Norton, QA, 4:53 p.m. Casey rode the elevator from the 9th floor down to her own offices on the 4th floor. She replayed the meeting with Martyr and decided he wasn't lying. His exasperation had been genuine, and it was true what Martyr said. Rumors flew through the plant all the time. A couple of years back, there was a week when the UAW guys had all come up to her asking solicitously, "How do you feel?" It was days before she learned there was a rumor she had cancer. Just a rumor. Another rumor. She walked down the corridor past the photographs of famous Norton aircraft from the past, with a celebrity posed in front. Franklin Delano Roosevelt beside the B-22 that carried him to Yalta. Errol Flynn with smiling girls in the tropics in front of an N-5. Henry Kissinger on the N-12 that had taken him to China in 1972. The photographs were sepia-toned to convey a sense of age and the stability of the company. She opened the doors to her offices, frosted glass with raised lettering, Quality Assurance Division. She came into a large, open room. The secretary sat in the bullpen. Executive offices lined the walls.
Norma sat by the door, a heavy-set woman of indeterminate age, with blue-rinse hair, and a cigarette dangling from her mouth. It was against regulations to smoke in the building, but Norma did as she pleased. She had been with the company as long as anyone could remember. It was rumored that she had been one of the girls in the picture with Errol Flynn, and that she had had a hot affair with Charlie Norton back in the 50s. Whether any of that was true or not, she certainly knew where all the bodies were buried. Within the company, she was treated with a deference bordering on fear. Even Martyr was cautious around her. Casey said, "What have we got, Norma?"
"The usual panic," Norma said. "Telexes are flying."
She handed a stack to Casey.
"The Pfizer in Hong Kong phoned three times for you, but he's gone home now. Pfizer in Vancouver was on the horn half an hour ago. You can probably still get him."
Casey nodded. It was not surprising that the flight service representatives in the major hubs would be checking in. The FSRs were Norton employees assigned to the carriers, and the carriers would be worried about the incident.
"And let's see," Norma said. "The Washington offices all a Twitter. They've heard the JAA is going to exploit this on Airbus's behalf. What a surprise. Pfizer in Dusseldorf wants a confirm it was pilot error. Pfizer in Milan wants information. Pfizer in Abu Dhabi wants a week in Milan. Pfizer in Bombay heard engine failure." I straightened him out. "And your daughter said to tell you she did not need her sweatshirt."
"Great." Casey took the faxes back to her office. She found Richmond sitting at her desk. He looked up in surprise and rose quickly from her chair.
"Sorry,"
Casey said. "Didn't Norma find you an office?"
"Yes, I have one," Richmond said, walking around the desk. "I was just wondering what you wanted me to do with this."
He held up a plastic bag with the video camera they had found on the plane.
"I'll take it."
He gave it to her.
"So what happens now?"
She dropped the stack of telexes on her desk.
"I'd say you're through for the day," she said. "Be here tomorrow at 7.
He left, and she sat down in her chair. Everything seemed to be as she had left it, but she noticed that the second drawer on the desk was not quite closed. Had Richmond been going through her desk? Casey pulled the drawer open, revealing boxes of computer disks, stationery, a pair of scissors, some felt-tip pens in a tray. It all looked undisturbed, but still. She heard Richmond leave, then went back down the hall to Norma's desk.
"That kid," she said, "was sitting behind my desk."
"Tell me," Norma said. "The little twerp asked me to get him coffee."
"I'm surprised marketing didn't straighten him out," Casey said. "They had him a couple of months."
"As a matter of fact," Norma said, "I was talking to Jean over there, and she says they hardly ever saw him. He was always on the road."
"On the road? A new kid, a Norton relative? Marketing would never send him on the road. Where'd he go?"
Norma shook her head.
"Jean didn't know. You want me to call travel and find out?"
"Yeah," Casey said. "I do."
Back in her office, she turned to the plastic bag on the desk, opened it, and pulled the videotape from the shattered camera. She set the tape to one side. Then she dialed Jim's number, hoping to talk to Allison, but she got the answering machine. She hung up without leaving a message. She thumbed through the telexes. The only one that interested her was from the FSR in Hong Kong. As always, he was way behind the curve. From Rick Rakowski, FSR, HK, to Casey Singleton, QAIRT, Norton BBK. Trans-Pacific Airlines today reports Flight 545 and N22 Fuse 271, Foreign Registry 098443, HBO9, flying from HK to Denver, experienced a turbulence upset during cruise FL370, approximately 0524, UTC position 39 North, 170 East. Some passengers and crew suffered minor injuries. Aircraft made emergency landing, LAX. Flight plan, passenger and crew, manifest attached. Please advise soonest. The telex was followed by four pages of passenger manifest and crew list. She glanced at the crew list. John Zeng Chang, Captain, March 7th, 1951.
Liu Zhangping, First Officer, March 11, 1959. Richard Young, First Officer, September 9, 1961. Gerhard Ryman, First Officer, July 23, 1949. Henri Marchand, Engineer, April 25, 1969. Thomas Chang, Engineer, April 29, 1970. Robert Sheng, Engineer, June 13, 1962. It was an international crew of the kind that often flew for charter companies. Hong Kong crews had often flown for the Royal Air Force and were extremely well-trained. She counted the names, 7 people. Such a large flight crew was not strictly necessary. The N-22 was designed to be flown by a 2-man crew, just a captain and first officer. But all the Asian carriers were expanding rapidly, and they generally carried larger crews for extra training hours. Casey went on. The next telex was from the FSR in Vancouver. From S. Nieto, FSR, Vancouver. 2. C. Singleton, QA, IRT. FYI. Flight crew TPA-545 deadhead on TPA-832 from LAX to Vancouver. First Officer Liu Zhangping taken off the aircraft at Vancouver. Medical emergency due to previously unrecognized head injury. First Officer comatose in Vancouver General Hospital. Details to follow. Remaining crew of TPA-545 transit back to Hong Kong today. So, the first officer had been seriously injured after all. He must have been in the tail when the incident occurred, the man whose cap they had found. Casey dictated a telex to the FSR in Vancouver, asking him to interview the first officer as soon as possible. She dictated another to the FSR in Hong Kong, suggesting an interview with Captain Chang on his return. Norma buzzed her. "No luck on the kid," she said.
"Why not?"
"I talked to Maria in travel. They didn't make Richmond's arrangements. His trips were charged to a special company account I set aside for foreign off-budget stuff. But she heard the kid ran up a hell of a big charge."
"How big?" Casey said.
"She didn't know," Norma sighed. "But I'm having lunch tomorrow with Evelyn in accounting. She'll give me everything."
"Okay, thanks, Norma."
Casey turned back to the telexes on her desk. They were all other business. Steve Young from the FAA's certification office asking about fire retardant test results on seat cushions the previous December. A query from Mitsubishi about burnouts of their 5-inch displays in the first class section of American N-22 wide bodies. A list of revisions of the N-20 aircraft maintenance manual, MP-06-6202. A revision of the prototype virtual heads-up display units to be delivered in the next 2 days. A memo from Honeywell advising replacement of the D-2 electrical bus on all FDA units numbered A-5059 through A-6098. Casey sighed and went to work. Glendale, 7:40 p.m. She was tired when she got home. The house seemed empty without Allison's lively chatter. Too tired to cook, Casey went into the kitchen and ate a cup of yogurt. Allison's colorful drawings were taped on the refrigerator